You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Everybody, welcome to the Paranormal Portal podcast. I hope you guys are having a wonderful night, and thank you so much for tuning in and supporting all that we're doing here on the podcast. It's been amazing. You guys have been amazing out there checking us out and subscribing and downloading, and it's just a real pleasure. Of course, I'm your host, Brent Thomas. This is the Paranormal Portal podcast, and once again, special thanks to Revolver Podcast for making all this possible. I got a great show lined up for you guys tonight. A longtime friend, not only of mine personally, but of the show, The Paranormal Portal, is joining us, and he is a paranormal investigator, and he's been on the show many times and shared some amazing experiences and what he's been through and insights and a lot of really incredible knowledge about a lot of tech used in paranormal research. His name is Mr. Dan Pruitt, and welcome to the show, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to talk to you again. It's been a while.
It has been a long time, and I really appreciate you being on the podcast because I know you brought some amazing stuff to the YouTube channel, and that was wonderful, but I really wanted you to be a part of this too because you've really brought a lot of clarity to, well, quite honestly, an area that is can be pretty nebulous and hard to really understand with paranormal investigating. And what I mean by that is that there's so many different approaches and so many ideas going around, and there's so much pop culture surrounding it. It's sometimes hard to understand what it really is versus what it's been made to be. So, you know, you being here was just a no-brainer for me.
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And yeah, it's definitely one of those fields that, you know, there's no standardization. There's the unity is getting better, and so there are a lot of people that do a lot of different things, and I think the important thing, you know, none of us knows exactly what it is that, you know, that we call the paranormal. So keeping an open mind is a big thing, and just absolutely love it.
Yeah, well, you know, and you've got such a down to earth and straightforward approach about it, and I've learned so much listening to you, and so many things that I wouldn't have known, not only about what it is and what you do, but just the ins and outs and nuances of all the different equipments and approaches. So it's been great, but you know, this has been a lifelong journey for you, and if you wouldn't mind, and I know you shared it on the YouTube channel, and on the radio show, but if you wouldn't mind sharing at least a little bit for our podcast listeners, how this all started for you.
Yeah, no problem. I have been interested in the paranormal for a long time. And then it kind of goes back to when I was a child, like most paranormal investigators. We lived in Bentonville, Arkansas, and we lived in a house that was active and had an intelligent entity. I wasn't necessarily aware of it. at the time, but my mom was, it was not uncommon for her to see shadows moving around the house, and quite often making their way into the room that I was sleeping in at night. And I don't remember any, you know, participating or, you know, witnessing any activity. The only memory I really have of that is I remember being in my bed at night and talking a lot, not necessarily to myself, not necessarily to someone else, but that was really, that's kind of my earliest memory of potentially something paranormal. And when I was 12, I lost a close cousin of mine. He had drowned in a local creek. And so naturally that kind of, you know, at 12 years old, that kind of makes for a little bit of a downer, and, you know, kind of drifted towards the macabre because of that. It's really the only way I think a young preteen can process that kind of thing. And from there, I had several just kind of one-off experiences, and it really all kind of, I didn't get into paranormal investigation until about probably about 7 years ago at this point. And by this time I was living in Seattle in an apartment with my wife and daughter, and it was an older apartment building. I think it was built in the 60s, and the landlord had decided it was time to replace all the plumbing in the building, the feeds and the drains. And that was quite the undertaking, and the whole building was kind of had plastic down on the floors and on the walls. It looked like, you know, looked like an episode of Dexter. And at the time, I used to snore really bad. So my de facto bed was the couch in the living room. And one night I was dead asleep. My cats, you know, they're good about keeping company and keeping me warm, and I specifically remember waking up to hearing one of our cats with that low growl. You know, when a cat's just really perturbed and kind of scared, they get that low growl. And she was staring at the front door, which I could see. I was laying on the couch, and before I didn't even have to move, I could just shoot my eyes over and see the front door. And I could, more appropriately, I could see the light coming under the door.
Okay.
And the cat was growling and started to get a little more intense with the growling. And I noticed, actively noticed, that the room was quiet. Other than the cat, the room was absolutely quiet. Now, we lived, we could look out our front window and see the Space Needle. I mean, we were nearly in downtown Seattle, and there was never a lack of noise. There was a train yard not too far from us. So being completely silent and still like that was kind of my first indicator that something was wrong. And then it was getting dark. And I've talked with you before about this phenomenon. It's called the creeping darkness. And every last bit of light in the room got sucked out. And the only thing I could see was the light coming under that front door. Mm-hmm. And that's about the time I noticed 2 feet step in front of the door. I could see the light blocked out where the feet were. And all of my cats at this point were, they just took off. Wow. They ran to another room in the house. They hid, and they didn't come out for, I think it was a day and a half or 2 days. It was a significant amount of time. They just would not step foot back in that living room. And I had the most crippling fear I've ever had in my life. I couldn't move. I didn't think I'd be able to breathe. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I couldn't do anything. I was just petrified, I guess is the term for it. Mm-hmm. And when I didn't think it could get any worse, the doorbell rang.
Oh, jeez.
And now we're talking about an apartment building that was built in the 60s. There were heavy wood doors. It was a secure building. You had to get buzzed in, or you had to have a key. Mm-hmm. And you had to go through two other wood doors to get to our apartment, where something could even be standing in front of our front door. And I had not heard any of that. The doorbell rang, and of course, you know, my heart's pounding, and I can barely breathe, and then the feet just disappeared. So no sound, no nothing.
It didn't just walk away. They just faded away, kind of, or?
Yeah, they were just gone.
Wow.
And it took a while before I worked up the courage to go to the door. Meanwhile, I didn't hear any other doors opening. I didn't hear anything else. And I was hyper focused on the whole situation. You can believe that. Mm-hmm. And when the light started coming back into the room, and I noticed, you know, the ambient street light shining into the windows, and I started hearing noises again, I worked up the courage to go over and open the door, and there was absolutely nothing there.
Oh man.
And, it was jarring. And it was probably about a week later, I was looking up the local paranormal groups because I was absolutely sure that what I'd witnessed was paranormal. And I absolutely was sure that I had to find out what it was. So that was kind of how I got started. Learned a lot from the Advanced Ghost Hunters of Seattle Tacoma. They're a great, great group of people and gave me a start. And yeah, that's really how it all started.
Wow. So it was really a baptism by fire. I mean, you were just kind of, it wasn't even a journey you were looking for. It just kind of found you.
It found me. I was not a, you know, I was a skeptical believer, and I've always been a skeptical believer. Mm-hmm. But had never really had any, intense activity like that happened before. I, you know, kind of pride myself as being a pretty brave guy, but there was absolutely nothing but crippling fear and darkness that I felt that night, and it was intriguing.
So there was never any history behind the location that would have maybe indicated what this thing could be, or you think it was just kind of a transient visitation and then gone? Or do you think it was attached to the property?
Well, the thing that sticks out in my mind is there was a heavy amount of construction going on at the time. And, sure. And since then I've learned, like a lot of people have, that changing environments like that will often trigger activity if there's activity to be, you know, to be had, if you will. So I never did any research on it, and I ended up kind of adopting a rule that I don't investigate my own home.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, you know, the first application of that rule. And nothing else ever happened. We moved into several different apartments in that same building. You know, we'd snatch up the bigger apartment when we could, and mm-hmm. A few, you know, after being an investigator for a few years and, you know, traveling around the country for my day job, I do a lot of travel. So I do a lot of investigating when I'm out, and it was not uncommon to drag something home. It was usually, you know, disembodied voices or shuffling, but would usually fade within a couple of days of being back home. But wow. There was, as far as anything on the property, I never felt anything else specific to the property. If I had to guess, it was almost something that I brought home with me.
Wow. That's intense. And you know, I've got to agree with you about the investigating your own property. Now to me, what it seems like is when you investigate, and you'll have to tell me how you feel about this, but when you investigate, it's like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like you're not only acknowledging, but you're encouraging, interaction. And so, you know, if you're investigating your own home at the end of that, you're probably, you know, it doesn't just turn off like a switch. Okay, I'm done. And now so are you. I think it encourages activity to continue and even maybe perpetuate. Is that your feeling on it as well?
Yes, absolutely. And I think when you know, things like EVP sessions, you know, trying to make contact with the paranormal or entities, you're definitely opening yourself up, and you never know what's floating around. We don't know what we don't know about the other side. And personally, I don't want to take any risks, you know, in bringing something in that could be harmful in any manner, to my family. I don't think my family should have to, suffer because of my, you know, my mad lust for the paranormal. So I make sure not to do that. And you know, I just can't imagine what would happen if I did an EVP session in my own home and there was some negative, threatening, you know, terrible entity that I made contact with. I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't be able to deal with that. So, that's why I have that rule.
Yeah, no, I think that's a smart thing to do. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people probably do this because, you know, A, it's convenient, and B, they probably got the idea just from, you know, our popular culture, with all of the, you know, proliferation of paranormal shows that are available, on any given day or night on any, you know, and it's not, you know, TV's not like it used to be, or even the internet, you know, with videos and such. But what is your takeaway from our popular culture? Do you think that does it fairly represent what paranormal investigating is to you?
I think it does and it doesn't. I think, you know, you heard me talk before about, you know, there's a difference between paranormal investigating and ghost hunting. Neither is right, neither is wrong. They both are what they are, and they both, you know, have their place. And I think paranormal investigating to me is primarily data driven, more of a parapsychology approach. Whereas ghost hunting is, you know, I'm going out and looking to get scared. I'm not necessarily documenting what I'm doing, but I'm going out and I'm looking for something for myself.
Right.
And the popular culture, I love that it used to be somewhat taboo. You know, it was kind of the kooky guy, you know, the ghost hunter down the street. If you look at, you know, movies like Poltergeist, you know, the original Poltergeist, and look at just kind of how the paranormal investigators were, how their characters were put together, and they were, you know, kind of on the fringe of society and kind of the weirdos. And I think with the multitude of paranormal shows that are out there and the many techniques and personalities that are out there, it's become more mainstream. It's become more acceptable. And to me, that's, you know, just in the nick of time, because there's a lot more activity than there used to be.
Oh, that's an interesting takeaway. Now, and if you don't mind me asking, what do you base that on?
Generally just the environmental data, the shifting of the Earth's magnetic fields, the thinning of, you know, the atmosphere and the ozone, allowing more cosmic radiation. I think that's kind of resulting in more activity because there's more energy to be consumed.
Oh, okay. That's amazing. And I have never had that discussion before. And I think that's, you know, I've often attributed, I guess, the rise in reported accounts and encounters with the ability of people to have that conversation, whereas before they just couldn't. But it has occurred to me, it's like, you know, has this always been this much going on, or is there something afoot? And I didn't know how or why, but that makes perfect sense to me. You know, I think that with that, other energies and maybe even new forms of energy that haven't been available before for these things to manifest or to provide activity with, you know, it might be a whole new ball game.
Yeah, I think it absolutely, and I think we're just in the, you know, the third inning of that ball game as far as, you know, how things are changing. There are a couple of pieces of equipment that I make sure to take anytime when I'm investigating, and I, you know, eventually made my way into data logging equipment, which was just a godsend. Anyone out there who is a serious paranormal investigator, you should be, you know, saving up or looking at data logging equipment, or getting, you know, a small computer like a Raspberry Pi and building your own. The data logging, I think, is where we're going to piece together the physics of what's happening. But the equipment that I always carry around, a magnetometer, you know, obviously EMF, and a Geiger counter is another one that I keep in my, I have the same few hoodies that I wear on investigations, and in that front pocket, I've always got a Geiger counter going. And, you know, so some people I investigate with, they're not fans of that sound, but, when you look at the, you know, the theoretical physics, behind some of, the theories of how paranormal activity happens, there's an opportunity for gamma radiation and bursts of gamma radiation. And I hope it never spikes, but I've got it there just in case it does.
Yeah. It's probably a good early warning thing. Like, it's getting really ugly here. Now, have you ever been on an investigation and felt that where the air turns like soup and it feels like you're pushing through just a mass of, like, everything just gets heavy?
Yeah, there's been several locations where I've encountered that real heavy phenomenon, and this kind of I can't move, I can't see, type of environmental activity, and I think probably the most prolific is Bobby Mackey's Music World in Wilder, Kentucky. That's a place I try and get to once a year at least, and I try and get there as many times as I can, because I'm sure in the coming years it's going to be condemned or fall apart, one of the two.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of those things that you've experienced after the break, but just before the break, we got a couple minutes here. You had just mentioned a second ago about things that you always bring, but say, what would you recommend that somebody getting started would acquire to get their foot on the ground?
I think the first thing, if you're wanting to investigate the paranormal and you're wanting to make contact with any potential entities that might be around, I think that the big thing is a voice recorder. And you know, people can start off, almost everyone's toting around a smartphone these days. And almost every smartphone has, you know, a voice recorder app, or you can download one. And EVP work to me is the bread and butter of paranormal investigation these days, just because, you know, visual evidence, you know, capturing something on video or on a camera is just, it's so rare. That EVP is the more common, you know, more harder to explain. You can attribute EMF spikes. You know, if someone is a new investigator and they go out and they buy a $200 millimeter and they start using that, you know, they get spikes. That's not necessarily paranormal activity. They might have a personal experience that makes them feel that spike in EMF is related to paranormal activity. But if you're really wanting to get into it, I think EVP work and voice recorder is probably the first thing you want to get.
And I think you're right. I think it's just amazing, some of the EVPs. And you met Mike Hetzel when we did the roundtable episode, and he's traveling all over the road. He's an over the road trucker as well as doing paranormal investigating. And some of the things he's found has been really neat, in that he's always got his pocket recorder with him and stuff. He'll be at a spot, and he says he just kind of picks up a vibe. And so he'll just start asking questions. And some of the EVPs he's caught have been really, really impressive, which to me, I find very profound, because usually I think of hauntings as area specific or, you know, very localized. But the idea that they may be as well transient and moving all over the place, these entities that we don't quite understand, whether they were human or not, I find that just really compelling. But he talks about his, you know, his carrying that EMF or the EVP voice recorder with him at all times, and some of the neat things that he's found.
Yeah, and, he's he's got the right idea, and he's does a great job. And I love talking to him, and I saw, you know, same thing. I've always got a voice recorder, and always have a voice recorder. It probably gets a little annoying for my family sometimes, but I'm always prepared to make contact wherever I am. And I think that's something if you're really into it, the more you do it, you're a magnet for it.
Right. Now, I do have to ask you, since you brought it up, and this is, you know, this show probably isn't going to be real here heavy gear heavy or really gear specific, but since you brought up the cell phone, now how is the quality of voice recording on a cell phone different, or is it equal to what you would get with a pocket digital recorder?
I think it's about equal. You can pick up, you know, pocket digital recorders on Amazon for $20, and there's some features that you won't have at an entry level voice recorder. So with a cell phone, you can generally, save the file, export it, you know, via email or SMS or some other method, and that's going to get you a little bit further than if you pick up a $20 Olympus voice recorder from Amazon that you can't download the digital file. I mean, there are methods of getting, the audio off of it, but they're usually not binary, not digital. They're a little more analog.
Okay.
So I think I would say start with your phone and save up. If you really want to get into EVP work, I would say save, between $100 and $200. I'm a huge fan of Tascam and Zoom voice recorders. Mm-hmm. I primarily use Zoom, but I think when it comes to voice recorders, you definitely get what you pay for to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Some of them are just a little asinine on the prices these days, but generally, if you're looking to really get clear audio, and you're wanting to cut down that machine noise because it's going to be there. There's an inherent amount of ambient noise whenever you're recording. You probably want to get into something a little higher end. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not going to get EVPs on a more inexpensive piece of tech. And I think a good example of that is the Panasonic DR60. Look at the reputation that it has in the paranormal community. People pay thousands of dollars for one of those things. And at this point, when you find one, it's over 20 years old. Wow. And it's, cheap material. And in the 90s, it was probably a $15 or $20 piece of equipment. And the quality is atrocious. But it's still, it turns out some pretty significant potential EVPs.
Wow. That's really intense. Okay, so I think this is probably a good chance for us to take a quick break, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go to break quick, but we will be right back with more of the Paranormal Portal podcast with our special guest tonight, Mr. Dan Pruitt. So don't go away, everybody. We'll be right back. Everybody, we're back and we're back at it. This is the Paranormal Portal podcast. So I don't know about you, but I'm having a great night and it's a great conversation. Our special guest tonight is Mr. Dan Pruitt, who's joining us right now. But he's been a longtime friend of the show and contributor to the portal for quite a long time and has just some amazing insights and understandings of paranormal investigating with the spiritual as his focus. Dan, before the break, we had mentioned a little bit about your journey as far as where you've investigated. You mentioned Bobby Mackey's, but could you run down a little bit of where you've been in your journey on this investigating?
Oh, you bet. Mackey's was my first big paranormal expedition. And after that first time at Mackey's was great. And I've been to Gettysburg. I didn't get to investigate the battlefield as much as I wanted to. I mean, it's a national park that, you know, that closes at dusk. And unfortunately my work hours usually take me past dusk. So, I have investigated a couple different, residential locations in Gettysburg that were just wild with activity, very interactive, just absolutely amazing places. I've been to St. Augustine in Florida and done investigating there at the old fort and around the city. It's kind of amazing. St. Augustine is just about everywhere you walk in St. Augustine was probably a graveyard at some point or cemetery at some point. Wow. So it's just, you know, another place that's ripe with activity. And I've been and all over California and Oregon and in a lot of places in Missouri. And I think one of my favorite places is in Missouri outside of Kansas City. Now it's called the Belvoir Winery, but it's, in its heyday, it was the Oddfellows, the social group. Oh. They had it was an orphanage. There was a old folks home on the property. There was a retirement home on the property. There was a hospital, fully functioning farm, and had a school, and just really big compound. And still, a lot of it's still standing, not used, largely in disarray, but available for investigative purposes. And that place, I just can't express enough how amazing that just expansive the place is. Just great location.
Wow.
Yeah, been a little bit of everywhere. Did some investigating in Berlin when I was over there for work in the Tiergarten. Not too far from the Reichstag, and had some interesting activity there that I tried to get several people to explain away and can't. Been a little bit of everywhere.
No, that's fantastic. Now, you said Oddfellows, and I don't know what the hell that group was, but there's some I don't understand really what they are. I know that Zach Bagans has a couple of skeletons, human skeletons, at his museum in Las Vegas that were apparently came from a Longfellow's whatever you call it, lodge or whatever their gathering place was. But I don't know what they are, but man, they really are Oddfellows.
Yeah, I'm not sure what their what their clandestine rituals may include. I've never done a lot of research on them personally, but from touring that location outside of Kansas City and investigating there, you can definitely tell that it's a community, and they definitely took care of each other, you know, cradle to the grave.
Right. Wow. Well, I guess, you know, there's that. So tell me, during your journeys, where was your most, I don't know, maybe the scariest experience would be a good place to start.
Scariest experience, I'll go ahead and say that's definitely Bobby Mackey's. and it didn't take long of being there my first night for things to start to happen. I pulled my first Class A EVP my first night at Bobby Mackey's, and I was still, you know, pretty fresh to investigating at this point, but I was there. I had a guide with me, but we were locked into the place. It was just the two of us. I had eyes on the guide at all time to make sure there was nothing fishy going on there. Mm-hmm. Did a great sweep of the upstairs, and I was going to make my sweep through the men's room, which, you know, I don't know how you can be into the paranormal and not hear about Bobby Mackey's or see the Ghost Adventures episodes or,
yeah,
you know, things of that nature. And so trying to go in there with as objective an approach as possible. And I made it about three steps into that men's room, and the next thing I knew, my stomach just turned out in knots and did flip flops, and I've never felt anything like that come out of my gut. It was cramps. It was everything all at once. And before I knew what was going on, I was on my butt on the floor, and I was scrambling to get out of there. And it took a couple years before I'd even go back in there again.
Wow.
Just the absolutely negative feeling, whatever was going on there did not want me around, did not want me in there. And I was happy to oblige that night.
Yeah, that's creepy. That's all kinds of scary. Because, you know, you hear those stories of people, you know, getting hurt in that way. Like, you know, suddenly they're investigating, the next thing they have twisted intestines and weird stuff like that. Like some of these entities or beings seem to be able to manipulate us on a physical level like that. And that's terrifying.
Yeah. And then, you know, most of the anomalies that we're looking for when we investigate the paranormal and think about it, EMF, you know, electromagnetic type of activity, we're looking for fluctuations in the magnetic fields. And, you know, I think it's pretty easy for us as humans to forget that our electrical, or, you know, our own electrical system, our nervous system is, you know, puts off its own fields, and it's not outside the realm of possibility that, you know, that could be manipulated and used against us. And we all know how powerful the nervous system is.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I don't blame you for getting the hell out of there. And I think it was Ghost Adventures that was there, and Nick Groff I don't remember whether if he got punched or something in the stomach as well, or something like that, or he claims anyways. And, you know, if that's credible or not, I can't say. I wasn't there, but it's interesting that you would have a similar experience in that same location.
Yeah, it's weird. Bobby Mackey it kind of has two personalities, in my opinion. The upstairs, you get completely different activity than you get from the downstairs. And the downstairs, the night after whatever happened going into the men's room there, I spent the next night in the downstairs. Mm-hmm. and did investigating down there. And that is where I saw my first partial apparition. I saw the top half of an old man glide away from me. I was just slack jawed. You have in your mind how you're going to react, and you're going to chase after it, and you're going to try and make contact. But the first time you actually see something, it's more disbelief and kind of trying to figure out what in hell just happened. And the guy that was with me noticed, because she was looking in the opposite direction, and she saw my eyes get huge, and I'm sure I was turning a little bit of pale, and she was like, "Oh, what happened?" And I said, "I just the old man," and she kind of did a slow nod, and she said, "Yes, that's the shuffler." And she said, "That's kind of funny." She said that only one other person had seen him before, but a lot of people have heard him. It was the top half of an old man glided away from me.
That's
absolutely stunning.
But that was a personal experience. You weren't able to document that, though.
No, we were still we had the lights on, and we were going around, and I was just kind of getting a feel for the layout, because I certainly don't want to, even with IR, traipsing around in the dark is risky business.
Yeah,
especially at a place like Bobby Mackey's that's in such disarray. I don't want to fall over and brain myself on a piece of rebar or something. So definitely make sure to get the lay of the land. And that's when that happened. So I didn't have any equipment in hand. It was a personal experience.
Wow. But you don't want to become part of the exhibit.
No, I'm not looking to get trapped there. I can think of other places that might be a little bit better. I wouldn't mind being a permanent resident, but that place is not one of them.
Right. Now, what I also found interesting is that in digging up the background, you found that a lot of the story surrounding the legends around Bobby Mackey's are not accurate. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The head and the well and Even the story of Johanna is folklore. It never happened. And there was a lady named Johanna that can be traced to the property, but she was not a dancer. And she was much older at the time that the supposed, you know, the tale that's usually told about the place happened. What I did find is that the area itself has a pretty bloody history. Going back, it was called Hangman's Gap or Hangman's Hollow or something like that. There were a lot of hanging executions in the 1800s. And the story of the slaughterhouse is true. There was a slaughterhouse on the property. They did have kind of tunnels or, you know, ditches that took the refuse from the slaughterhouse floor out into the river, not too far away, the Licking River there. Mm-hmm. So that was true. And then as you kind of get into the 1900s, the history is a little more accurate. You'll find that in most cases with active locations, a little more easily documented and a lot more credible.
Wow. Now, do you find that a lot when you're checking out locations that the legends are so far from reality, or is it just kind of hit or miss on that kind of stuff?
It's kind of hit or miss. Sometimes it's been documented properly, and there are records that have been reviewed, and the history has been accurately reflected. Mm-hmm. In the case of Bobby Mackey's, you have someone like Carl Lawson, who was a caretaker there for a long time, who had a lot of, you know, a lot of problems, mm-hmm. Chemical dependence problems and, you know, some mental health issues. And, the fear factor of some of the stories, I think, is that's more exciting. You know, if I'm telling a story, if I'm telling a ghost story, people are going to want to hear more about, the scary things that happened. Then, nothing. There was no such thing as Pearl Bryan. Her head was never cut off. No one ever said they'd haunt the place. You want to keep an audience. You want to get the story retold. It's going to be the more fake scary things that get conveyed through history than the facts and documented accounts.
Yeah, sensationalism sells, I guess, so that makes sense. But so you saw the half apparition and you had the crippling pain in your stomach. What about another location where some profound activity happened?
The Ohio State Reformatory at Mansfield, more commonly known as Mansfield Reformatory, is... And most people will, if they haven't heard of it, then they'll definitely kind of, they'll probably recognize the layout from, the movie, what was that with Tim Robbins, Shawshank Redemption, was filmed there.
Oh, okay.
And, it was in service for quite a long time. And it's a historical site now. Mm-hmm. And above one of the cell blocks, close to the chapel, there's an attic, really high ceiling attic. And I was there with a group of people from Seattle, and we had the whole place to ourselves. We were locked in all night, and we, all of us, so everyone was accounted for. Mm-hmm. And there's an actual functioning prison a couple hundred yards away, so there's not much, you're not going to get a lot of kind of hokey, crazy things going on because there's the one side of the old prison. You can't even take pictures looking towards the functioning prison. That's a couple hundred yards away. Oh. If you're caught taking pictures, they will come, they will arrest you, they will interrogate you. So, you can't really get away with a lot there.
Sure.
In this attic, it's kind of been known as a hot spot. The inmates used to spend time up there. It was a little more of a recreational area. So we had five people. We had a bevy of equipment running and logging data. Probably the most important to that night was the ambient light detection. When we're talking about an attic with one door and no windows, we all five of us at one point started hearing footsteps walking around us.
Oh, wow.
You shine a light, there would be nothing there. And everyone felt it. Everyone heard it. And then, one of the guys that was with us kind of blurted out. He's like, "Is it getting darker in here?" And I had been thinking the same thing. And I've experienced that phenomenon before. And then usually right before something crazy happens, and, it got darker and it got darker and it got darker and it'd get a little bit lighter and then it'd get darker and darker and the footsteps would pick up all around us. And then in about 15 minutes it just stopped. And, when we were pretty sure that the activity had died down, I immediately ran over and started pulling data off of the sensors that we had, and the ambient light detector backed up our experiences. You know, we were able to see that the ambient light in the room, as minimal as it was, dropped significantly. And the temperature dropped, and we were able to correlate various points of data to that activity. And that was probably, as far as paranormal investigating and kind of the parapsychology approach, the more kind of, you know, lab-based approach, that's one of the more significant experiences I've had.
That is really cool. And it's neat because I think most of us probably have had that experience where it's like you're in a dark room and it seems to get darker and it's already dark. It's, you know, it's like, well, how dark can it get? You know, that it just can, it can be really bizarre, but to actually corroborate that with a data set, I think is just really, really impressive. Now it didn't, it wasn't accompanied with that same fear that you felt when you were in your apartment.
There wasn't any fear there. And I, you know, completely, non-scientific, opinion, I don't think what was happening was, it wasn't an entity that had ever been human. I'm not saying it was a demon. I'm not saying it was some kind of crazy non-human entity. I think it was just some amalgamation of the pain and the anger and just all the emotion that had built up in the place for so many years. Mm-hmm. And, came by and showed off a little bit and off it went.
Thank God. That you're talking about the prison in this situation, right?
Yes.
Okay. So do you have an opinion about what it was back in the apartment? I don't know if we really covered that, but I mean, it's such a similar phenomena, but it seems that it was two very different causations, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I have no way of, it's a personal experience. Yeah. So I guess a personal opinion goes with a personal experience, but in my apartment, I am convinced if I would have went and opened the door while I was still seeing the feet, I would have been looking at a black eyed kid.
Oh, okay. Very cool. And well, not really cool, but you know what I mean? It's like, wow, that is intense. Oh, and thank God you didn't.
No, well, you know, you learn to listen to your body in these situations. And then once your body will tell you when something is up, and sometimes you fight through it because you're just after that data, and you'll end up paying for it one way or the other. And if you're doing what your body tells you, you get the hell out of there, you stay put, one of the two.
No, I appreciate that. I can respect that. I think that I agree that we seem to have, you know, spiritual receptors of our own. And when something really dark and really evil is around, you're going to know it on a real fundamental level. It's not just, wow, that's really creepy, I don't understand it, now I think it's evil. It's you feel that waves of evil coming off of something really dark. And I can't say I have a whole lot of experience with that, but I've had times where I've encountered something and I don't know what it was, but I know that inside my intuition was just screaming, don't pursue that. Do not go anywhere near that. and I listened as well. And, you know, it's one of those things.
Yeah. Well, you know, the old saying, trust you get.
Yeah. You know, and that's some people in our Western sensibilities, I think we dismiss those kind of things, those kind of wisdoms. But I think that there's some mechanism, whether it's some kind of a psychic awareness, whether it's just, you know, we have some kind of receptors within our bodies that we don't quite understand yet, but can detect that kind of situation. Now, one thing that occurs to me is, and this is somewhat related in that it seems like things can tell when something is wrong. Now, I've told the story a few times on the show of this time where an old friend of mine, her husband was away. She was home alone with the baby. They live up in the mountains, and their dog, their German Shepherd, would not settle down. It was like 15 minutes just barking, just being absolutely freaking out. And she asked if I would come up there and, you know, take a look. And I was like, well, okay. So I did. I got in my car and drove out there. And I got there, and as soon as I got out of my car, the dog, of course, I was hearing barking. While I called to him, he came over and settled down a little bit, but his hackles were up, like he had a mohawk all the way down his back. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I noticed once he quit barking was everything was quiet. Even crickets were quiet. And that's the part I think that really freaked me out the most, is that how do crickets know, you know? So even like the crickets knew whatever was around was dangerous. Now, it could have just, you know, could be a mountain lion, could be a large predator, but whatever it was, even, you know, all of the ambient nature around knew to shut the hell up, you know? And,
yeah.
And that to me was amazing, because you think of bugs and it's like, what are they concerned with? You know, it's like, what do I eat now? You know, I mean, that's about it. And, you know, procreation. But then here it was having a function that I wouldn't have thought possible. So I just find that really amazing.
Yeah, to me, at least I hope that someday we'll be able to quantify whatever that is, whether it's some kind of temporal, you know, distortion or temporal activity, or it's some kind of, you know, radiating magnetic or electric field, or maybe it's just something that we, you know, some type of something quantifiable we haven't wrapped our head around yet. I think it's physical. I think everything in this field, if you will, at one point or another can be traced back to physics. Do we understand all the physics yet? Absolutely not. Right. But I think it's all physical at the end of the day.
No, I agree with you. I think there's a lot, you know, and that's the one thing about being involved in the paranormal is that I guess the one takeaway for me is how little we really do know about what's going on around us. And we know a lot, and I'm not degrading the sciences or anything, but it's like there are so many more things going on that we just haven't even understood enough to even study. And I think this is one of those fields. It's, you know, these energetic beings that seem to be all around us, and yet we have very little or no understanding of.
Yeah, and you take things like the Large Hadron Collider, and I think what's that more prominent British physicist, Brian Cox, is that his name? Brian.
Yep.
I think it's Brian Cox. Right. He had, you know, been quoted a few years ago as saying that, you know, these test results from the Large Hadron Collider prove that there's no such thing as ghosts. There's no such thing as the paranormal. And you know, to that kind of opinion, I say, well, then tell me what the paranormal is. Tell me what it is.
Right.
Tell me physically what this activity is, for sure, you know, with the scientific method, then I will, you know, I will probably tell you that you're right, but I guarantee you, until you can tell me what it is, you can't tell me that it isn't.
Yeah, good point. And I think that that's important too, is that there's so many people prematurely shutting the doors on this because it doesn't fit into a paradigm. And even our understanding, even from the Large Hadron Collider, we may very well find out that there's layers upon layers upon layers of particles we weren't even aware to look for, you know, but they're looking for a certain data set based upon particle physics as we understand it. But I just can't even believe we're anywhere near cracking that eggshell and getting to, you know, what's possible.
All right, and I think we're getting there. You know, kind of breakthrough things like, you know, kind of the experiment that proves, you know, entanglements that came out of MIT, you know, things like that. And thinking about, you know, quantum networking in general, that gives me hope that we're sniffing the right trail and we're just, the technology's improving. Mm-hmm. I think the closer we can get to quantum computing and we'll have the means, maybe not the amount of data that we need, but we'll have the means to start unraveling these mysteries.
Yeah, and there's plenty of them, that's for sure. Just quickly, is there any other single event that really pops out to you as a very defining moment in your journey?
Yes, probably my favorite, if you will. I made contact with an entity in Gettysburg. I'd hooked up with the Gettysburg Paranormal and was at, they call it the Harmon Murder House. Mm-hmm. It's a little misrepresented, and I'll explain why. So this is a place that, you know, like most residents or, you know, residential locations in Gettysburg, can be traced back to Civil War, pre-Civil War. And this place had been a hospital. You know, during Civil War, I think most houses that could, you know, take soldiers in were hospitals in one way or the other during that time.
Sure.
And in the 80s, there was a couple that lived there. The lady's name was Debbie. And she was shot by her boyfriend one day. She was shot in the chest. Mm-hmm. And she later died at a local area hospital. And it was quite the scandal, because her boyfriend at first gave the story that he was cleaning his gun and it accidentally discharged. And then his story started falling apart, and he was put on trial and eventually found guilty. And when I was there with, there were three other people with me. One being kind of a guide, you know, member of the Gettysburg Paranormal Team. Mm-hmm. The other two being investigators that were visiting from Australia. And they were up on second floor. They were investigating there, and I was down on the main floor investigating and was doing an EVP session in the kitchen. And I could feel... something was going on. Uh-huh. I usually get that feeling in my stomach, like I said, and I knew something was around. And when I went back and reviewed the audio, I clearly, and I've got these on my YouTube channel, these EVPs. As I was walking from one room to the other, there was a female voice that called out, "Sweetie." And then there were a few other EVPs, you know, in the other room, and including a really distinct moan. And I felt it. Actually, I know I made contact with this woman, and it turns out after the investigation and kind of getting back in touch with the team, I'm getting goosebumps talking about it right now. Mm-hmm. Getting back in touch with the team, they were able to show audio and play several, show audio and video clips of same thing.
Wow.
Debbie still hangs around there and she makes contact. She's very lonely. Uh-huh. And she's looking for someone to talk to and make a connection with. And that's probably, making contact with her was one of the most profound things I think I've ever felt. I have EVPs that came out of it, but I can't, you know, there was a lot of personal experience there that I can't relate. There were feelings there that I can't relate. And I would just love to go back because she was so sweet. it was really, really interesting.
That is really cool. And I just, it's really cool that you come on the show and share your experiences and your insights with all of us, brother. How can people stay in touch with what you're doing?
My poorly neglected Facebook page is Red Eyes and Dead Batteries. I moved from Seattle to Boise last summer, and spent more time on the road in the last year than I would have liked. But I'm getting to the point now to where I'm in Boise a lot more, so I'm starting to get out and investigate here. And any chance I get, I want to take. You know, I want to bring the experience to people that can't be there, and share. I think there's a lot that's missing in the paranormal community with sharing data and sharing experiences and just all around unity. So I want to try and foster that. So Red Eyes and Dead Batteries is started out as my blog. Mm-hmm. Red Eyes, because I used to take a lot of red eye flights, flying around the country for work, and Dead Batteries, I think any paranormal investigator can relate to. So that was a blog that kind of turned into a Facebook page, and that's primarily people can reach out to me through there. I love to work with teams all over the country. I love to kind of answer questions, you know, based on my opinion and my experience, and I can definitely. I'm happy to consult on tech, review anything. Feel free to get a hold of me.
Well. Yeah. Thank you so much, brother. And I can't tell you again how much I appreciate this. And thank you for taking the time tonight to be here with us.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. It's always great to talk to you. And we'll have to do this again soon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you just tell me when you're available and I'll make room for you. But thank
you. All right. You got it.
Thank you all so much for being a part of the episode tonight and of all of our episodes and supporting our endeavors here in the podcasting world. And if you want to stay in touch with what we're doing, head over to youtube.com/paranormal portal, and you can see I don't know how many episodes. I think we're in like the 300s for episodes on YouTube, and it catalogs quite a long journey when the show was just starting to wherever it is now. And so hopefully some great episodes there that you want to check out. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/paranormal portal radio, and find us on Twitter at Paranormal Portal, P-O-R-T-L, not P-O-R-T-A-L. So it's Paranormal, P-O-R-T-L on Twitter. And I'm definitely looking to expand my Twitterverse, but I'm not much of a tweeter as it turns out, but I'm working on it. So if you got a Twitter, check it out. Check us out there. And again, special thanks to Revolver Podcast for making all this possible. And we will be back with another episode. The podcast uploads 3 times a week, ladies and gentlemen, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So there's always a new portal coming. And if you need more than that, head over to YouTube. We are live 7 days a week, 7 p.m. Pacific time. So check it out. And, you know, if you know other people that love the paranormal, then let them know about the portal. And if you have an experience of your own that you'd like to share, please feel free to email it to paranormalportalradio@gmail.com. So that's about it from us. Be good, be kind, be nice, take care of each other, help each other out, find the magic in every day, and remember to laugh as much as you can. Good night, everybody.
sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.